Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is behind bars today, awaiting word on his future and how long he might spend in prison. The jury in his murder trial deliberated for just over 10 hours before it reached a guilty verdict yesterday on three charges related to the death of George Floyd. Joining us now is Joyce Vance. She is a professor of law at the University of Alabama. Joyce, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And what's your takeaway from this verdict and from this jury that apparently believed what they saw in that video, what we all saw in that video, that Derek Chauvin murdered George Floyd?
It's a little bit remarkable that we have to view this verdict as remarkable. The evidence, after all, was overwhelming. The prosecution's closing argument more than justified that it had met its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt on each of the three counts Chauvin was charged in. But as we all know, verdicts like this, let alone prosecutions, are all too rare in our country. That's because of many factors, but certainly cultural biases in favor of law enforcement, and also how stringent legal provisions are that permit prosecutors to prosecute police officers.
I'm thinking about the 12 members of the jury who sat through this trial. Few of us have ever had to do something with such profound consequences. What kind of effect do you think these last couple of weeks have had on them?
These images that they've been exposed to were very searing. They were hard to watch even at the removed distance of a television monitor. One suspects that the impact on the jury will be long-lasting. Perhaps it will require some of them to seek some counseling, and perhaps that's an important thing for us to say out loud, because the trauma that we see in a case like this impacts the family and the victims directly, but it impacts larger communities. And an important part of moving the country forward and fixing these problems is appreciating that it's bad for all of us, not just for George Floyd or not just for black people, but for all of us.
Yeah. As I had mentioned, one of the next big questions will surround Chauvin's sentencing. Now, he decided to waive his right to have the jury decide on the aggravating factors that could be considered in his sentence, which means it's now fully in the judge's hands. What will Judge Cahill consider as he starts to make that decision?
There's always a little bit of confusion about sentencing because the statutes, the laws in this case that the Minnesota State Legislature has passed, sets a statutory maximum sentence. But the judge will really be guided by Minnesota's sentencing guidelines, which set really a recommended sentence for both the murder in the second degree and murder in the third degree charges at 150 months, about 12 and a half years. That's before any enhancements that the judge might choose to apply.
Well, and he might choose to apply some of those enhancements. Can you walk through what you mean by that?
Sure. Sentences can be increased for aggravating factors. So in this case, the prosecution is likely to ask the judge to consider the fact that George Floyd was a vulnerable victim. He was handcuffed at the time that he was killed, and also that there was a minor present, a 9-year-old child who viewed the crime. These are the types of factors that judges are permitted to consider when they decide whether the sentence set by the guidelines is appropriate or whether the defendant's conduct deserves something more serious.
From a legal point of view, why do you think that Chauvin decided to put that decision in the judge's hand, to not let the jury consider those aggravating factors?
I think that was a predictable decision for Chauvin to make. Once the jury had already, in essence, condemned his conduct, not just with one conviction, but with a conviction on all three counts, it seems like the better option, and certainly something his lawyer probably counseled him to do, was to permit the judge to make this decision, hoping that the judge, that his consideration would be cabined more strictly by legal factors than by any hint of outrage or disgust at Chauvin's actions.
Okay, so that's Chauvin's future. We assume there will be an appeal. We'll wait and see on that. But looking ahead now, three other officers who were at the scene will be tried together in August. They've all been charged with aiding and abetting second-degree murder and also aiding and abetting second-degree manslaughter. Did we learn anything here in the Chauvin trial that would offer any hints at how this next one will go?
We did. We learned a great deal. We saw what most of the evidence against the other officers looked like. And perhaps as importantly, we heard when the judge instructed the jury in Chauvin's case what his instructions about aiding and abetting liability look like. And the judge, in essence, told the jury, and it was a little bit of a misfit, right, in Chauvin's case, but nonetheless it was charged this way, so the judge gave the jury the legal instruction. Aiding and abetting requires more than mere presence. You actually have to counsel or participate or otherwise signify your intent to help in the crime
Joyce
that's
Vance,
committed.
Thank you. I'm going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Minnesota State Representative John Thompson now. He's been part of efforts to push for police reform there. Representative Thompson, what has the last 24 hours been like for you?
You know, we celebrate the victory, the conviction. And then as we're celebrating, we hear that there's a 15-year-old child killed in Ohio. So just like this George Floyd killing, you know, we're mourning George Floyd and waiting the verdict, and a 20-year-old young man gets killed in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota. So you don't have time to really like celebrate before there's another one and another one and another one and another one. And we're preparing for another one until we can get real reform put into legislation. We'll have another police involved killing in the state of Minnesota is how I feel. So like it felt good. This guy had a brand new pair of like platinum bracelets yesterday for, you know, the murder that he committed. This was beautiful. We really need to like convince our Republican Senate that reform is needed.
Representative, you and I spoke just a few days ago, and you expressed how weary you were by the legislative process, the elements of the public discourse, and really how traumatic it is as a Black man to watch all of this unfold. For the folks who don't know, you were friends with Philando Castile. He's a Black man who was shot and killed during a traffic stop by police a few years ago. What significance, if any, does this verdict mean for your job as a legislator moving forward?
For me, I have to keep working. I have to keep working and inspiring people to do some of the same work that I'm doing. That's how we get the victory. Like, this was a small victory because no one ever, except for an African-American cop, been convicted of killing anybody here in this state. No, we've watched this time and time again. The politicians being punked by police unions, and that's the truth. When people say, well, we can't do that, the Chiefs Association will never go for that. Well, the Chiefs Association has to admit that they have a problem. Your profession is becoming a profession that nobody wants to do anymore. You know, so no, I'm although I'll celebrate the George Floyd, your family getting the victory for the George Floyd, there's so many others and more to come. And it sucks. Like, you got to understand, man, like, these traffic stops turn these cars into caskets for young men, right? I'm nervous when those disco lights come on behind me, especially if I'm in a car by myself, you know? Like, I'm nervous because I don't know who's going to walk up to that car and what type of attitude they're going to have.
When we spoke to you on Monday, you made a plea to President Biden and Vice President Harris that, hey, we need help. Here's Vice President Harris speaking last night.
A measure of justice isn't the same as equal justice. This verdict brings us a step closer, and the fact is, we still have work to do. We still must reform the system.
Your thoughts on the Vice President's comments, Representative Thompson, is this part of what you want to hear or see from the Biden administration?
100%. You know, I never heard that until you just played it. And that just made me smile. Like, wow, somebody's really listening to us. Now, if they can hop on a flight and come down here and make good on their promise, that'd be another thing. And these are times where the people needs to see them, not representation from the president or the vice president. We need to see you. Our community needs to see you. Our community needs to talk to you, not somebody who represents your office. And so come here. Come here and talk to the people who are right here in the thick of it. And let's work it out together. We'll invite them there. Like, invite us there. But let's work this out together. Let us show you what we're trying to do here. And give us some help. We need help from our president. Man, I really love Kamala Harris. She is what Black excellence looks like for me. So, when she said that and you just played that, it just made me smile because really there's somebody who gets it. We need reform.
That's Minnesota State Representative John Thompson. Representative Thompson, thank you so much for talking with us again.
Thank you for having me.
The Justice Department said today that it will investigate the Minneapolis Police Department. Attorney General Merrick Garland says he wants to address potentially systemic policing issues after the death of George Floyd.
Most of our nation's law enforcement officers do their difficult jobs honorably and lawfully. I strongly believe that good officers do not want to work in systems that allow bad practices.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murder yesterday after he kneeled on the neck of George Floyd. And our next guest says by doing that, Chauvin set policing back a decade. Lorenzo Boyd is a criminal justice professor, former sheriff's deputy, and a police consultant and trainer. Lorenzo, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
What message did that verdict send to rank-and-file police officers around the country yesterday?
I think that the guilty verdict on all counts is a huge win for policing across this country, because most police officers are good people that really want to make a difference in their community. And this was a black eye on policing across the nation. And this actually gives police officers the chance to say, that's not us, and help police officers re-engage with the community. So this was a good verdict for all.
Do you believe that police departments and police officers around the country are actually having that conversation today, whether it's formally or informally, or is it just business as usual?
Well, it depends on the department. Most police departments around the country are not a major department like Boston, New York, or Philly. Most police departments are really small that may have 10, 12, 20 people in it. The progressive departments are absolutely having this conversation because they're forced into it, because the police are thrust into the national spotlight again. So they don't want this type of negative press. So most departments are having this conversation.
I hear you that most police officers are going to say that what Chauvin did was wrong and that he should have been served justice, that he was a bad apple. I wonder, though, if you don't worry, that police departments and individual officers will use that as an excuse not to lift the mirror in front of their own face and fail to focus then on deeper systemic reforms that the policing system needs in this country.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, because I would stop just short of saying this was justice. This was clearly accountability. Justice would be something that would help bring, make somebody whole again. We can't bring back George Floyd. So having said that, there's definitely some officers that still believe in the us versus them mentality through no fault of their own, because we haven't changed the way we've done police training in about 110 years since we ushered in the era of professionalism in policing. So it's still the us versus them, and there's still a bunch of people that said that could have been me and we need to stand by and protect the other officer. But the officers that say that aren't looking at the totality of what's going on. So if we can get people to take more of a national view, even though policing is amazingly local, they would say, you know what? We need to make sure something like this doesn't happen again.
And the day after George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, the police department issued a very vague press release that said a man had died, and this is a quote, after a medical incident during police interaction. It was at the very least a gross underrepresentation of the truth. It said nothing about Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck. And, if we didn't have that bystander video, we might actually never know what happened to George Floyd. So what is it going to take do you think to close the trust gap between police departments and the communities that they serve?
Well, the one thing that's going to solve that is reimagining training. The buzzword is we want to reimagine policing, but for me, we need to go even further than that, because putting good people in a bad policing system is problematic. We have to have a holistic approach to training the police, and there are four elements that we need. One is we need to increase levels of compassion. Two, we have to increase levels of empathy. Three, we have to increase critical thinking skills and have the police become problem solvers. And number four, we have to increase communication, because a good police officer avoids using force through effective creative communication. If we go that way and start training the police differently and they stop viewing the citizens as potential suspects, if they start trying to work with the police, I think that's a pathway forward. But we certainly have to reimagine training and stop putting good people in bad situations.
Lorenzo Boyd, criminal justice professor, former sheriff's deputy, and police consultant and trainer. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just before the Chauvin verdict came down yesterday, I spoke with Sharon Fairley. She's a professor at the University of Chicago Law School who's been following another police killing. 13-year-old Adam Toledo was shot in late March. Video released last week showed a Chicago police officer chasing the boy down an alley. When Adam stopped and put his hands up, the officer shot him. Police say he had a gun. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot said afterward that she wants to change the way police chase suspects on foot.
We cannot and will not push the foot pursuit policy reform off for another day. As mayor, I am directing that a new policy be in place before the summer.
Here's my conversation with Professor Fairley about those reforms. First, I want to get your thoughts from the video of the officer chasing Adam Toledo through that alley. It all happened very, very fast, but what are you taking away from it?
Yeah, well, so like you said, the first thing you notice is that this happened extremely quickly. And as much as we here after the fact can sort of take apart the video and diagnose it piece by piece, that's not what the officer was doing in that moment. It's obviously tragic, but unfortunately, not that unusual.
Well, and it ended in tragedy, as you say, and it's not uncommon. In 2016, the Chicago Tribune found that foot chases played a role in more than a third of Chicago police shootings over the course of a five-year period. But what is it about the foot pursuit that does make it so dangerous, not only for the person who's being pursued, but for the officer?
I think it boils down to a very simple thing. Imagine you're running after someone. You think he or she might have a firearm, and they're running away, but they're also turning around to look back to see how close you are. And in that moment, that creates concern that they're actually turning around to cause harm.
Well, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot says she wants to change it. She's calling for reforms. In your opinion, in your experience, what would foot chase reform look like?
Well, I think we have a model in that there are, you know, policies around when you can do a car chase, for example, right? Because we know that those also are very, very dangerous. You know, we can put in place questions around what is the law enforcement purpose of this chase, and is it worth the risk that it presents to both the officer and the individual? Now, that being said, you know, when an officer is pursuing someone who's clearly committed, you know, a violent crime and presents an imminent threat to others around him, that's not the question. The question is on the circumstances that are perhaps on the margin, and we're just not so sure what threat this person really represents to the officer or anybody else.
Could you give an example of that? Because I'm thinking that exact thing. At what point could the officer make the decision, you know what, I'm not going to run after that person. I'm just going to let him or her go, because it would be safer to do that.
Yeah. So the one case that comes to my mind is a Chicago incident involving a young man named Dakota Bright, who police came upon Mr. Bright in an alley, and he took off running. And the officers said that they saw a firearm in his hands, but he quickly dropped the firearm, probably surreptitiously, so they didn't really see where it landed. And so one officer continues to chase this young man And he starts running through and jumping over fences across backyards in a Chicago residential neighborhood. And ultimately, the chase was ended by a shot at Mr. Bright. The officer claimed that he turned around, and the officer claims that he thought that he still had the gun and that he was going to shoot him. Now, the physical evidence showed that he was shot in the back of the head. Hmm. But that to me is the quintessential, you know, example of you know, how these chases can go wrong.
Yeah. People are upset in the Chicago area that these reforms have taken so long to come about. And you were appointed to Chicago's Independent Police Review Authority after Laquan McDonald was shot and killed by police in October of 2014. Do you think that we're at a point now where significant changes to policing in Chicago will happen? I mean, they've already been mandated by the consent decree.
Yeah. So again, like, I remain cautiously optimistic about the potential for a reform, but reform is really difficult. And when you talk about reforming a police department that's 13,000 people strong, changing that culture is not going to happen overnight. So what has to happen in the meantime is that there are policies and procedures that are put in place that are then strictly enforced, because that will hopefully change the behavior while the attitudes are still in the process of being changed. You know, the mayor has been working in this space, right? She was the president of the Police Accountability Task Force. She understands the need for reform. Now she's responsible for managing the department and understands the complexity of pushing through reform. Mm. But we have to keep pushing forward because people are dying. Young Black men are losing their lives. We have to do it in a way that helps maintain public safety while also pushing through, you know, reform.
Sharon Fairley is a professor at the University of Chicago Law School. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
In stressful times, you want to spend your time checking out not just what's best, but what's best for you. We know you care about what you watch, what you read, and what you listen to. NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast is with you 5 days a week to make sure that time is well spent. Listen now to the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Less than an hour before Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murdering George Floyd, another person died in a police shooting. Makaia Bryant, a 16-year-old Black girl, was fatally shot by an officer outside of her home in Columbus, Ohio, after authorities say she called police for help. Joe Ingles is a reporter for Ohio Public Radio and Television. She's been covering this, and she joins us now for more. Joe, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So, Joe, take us through what we know happened. Police received a call from Bryant. What exactly happened?
Well, Bryant's aunt and her family members say Makaia Bryant called the police. She said that she was under threat from others who were in her home. This all happened around the same time that the verdict in the Chauvin case was coming in from Minnesota. And so it was kind of crazy when they got there because there were people out in the yard, and officers had to make quick determinations. And it ended up that Makaia Bryant was shot four times.
Let's talk about these very quick decisions that police had to make. We see there is an edited body camera video. We're being told that this is an incomplete video. Police say that Bryant was attempting to stab two girls. Is that clear from the video?
Well, it's very unclear to me watching it whether she has a knife in her hand. It does look like she has something, is doing something with her hand. Police say, however, that she had a knife in her hand. You could see some sort of fight with some other people standing around in the front yard. But it was very chaotic.
What do we know about this young woman, Bryant?
Well, the Franklin County Children's Services says that she was a foster child, although her mother was at the scene and so was her grandmother. So, you know, they must be pretty close where they can respond quickly. One thing that's been very unclear to us is her actual age, because the police and some are saying 15, and then Franklin County Children's Services and her mother says 16. Either way, she's very young.
We know this happened just before many groups gathered around the country in anticipation of the verdict for Derek Chauvin.
What has been the response in the Columbus area?
Protesters have been out there. They were very upset with this. You've got to remember, this isn't the first time that Columbus police has had a situation that's been questioned. And this really just kind of made it worse, you know, made it even more apparent that there is something between the Columbus police and a good portion of the Columbus community.
You know, the public discussion right now centers around accountability for police misconduct. We know that authorities are still parsing out what happened in this case, but more broadly, what has been the discussion about police reform there in Columbus?
Well, they have established a civilian review committee that is going to deal with police matters and will likely be looking at this. And also, it's important to note that the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation is looking into this. So it kind of remains to be seen what happens from here and where they go.
Joe Ingles is a reporter for Ohio Public Radio and Television. Thank you so much for this update.
Well, thank you.
We're continuing to follow our top story today, reaction to the guilty verdicts against Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd. But we also do need to spend a few moments on the global pandemic. More than 3 million people have now died around the world since it started more than a year ago. We have three reporters in three different countries now where the virus is raging. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley is in Paris. Hi, Eleanor.
Hello, Peter.
And Philip Reeves is in Rio de Janeiro. Phil, hello.
Hi.
And we have Lauren Frere in Mumbai, India. Lauren, welcome to you.
Hi there.
And Lauren, let's start with you. In fact, India is now recording nearly 300,000 new COVID infections per day. That's staggering, even when you account for a population of 1.4 billion people in the country. How would you characterize what's happening in India right now?
I mean, I would characterize it as a five-alarm health emergency. Hospitals in Delhi say they will probably run out of oxygen at some point today. Oxygen deliveries are coming in under police guard because of the danger of looting. People are buying oxygen tanks on the black market and stockpiling them at home because there is simply no point in trying to get to a hospital now. There are crowds of people outside of hospitals in cities across India. They are dying in parking lots outside because they can't get in. We're seeing shortages of antiviral drugs, even test kits. So, yes, today India confirmed 295,000 new cases. But the real number is probably many, many times that because people aren't even able to get tested. And also, sadly, more and more deaths. Morgues and crematoriums are overloaded. It's really hard to imagine how this could get any worse here.
Oh, my goodness. Well, how did it get so bad, Lauren? I mean, it wasn't long ago. I was speaking to reporters in India that felt the number of infections had gotten under control and things that were looking pretty good.
It was. It was looking really good. 2 months ago, it seemed like COVID had pretty much disappeared here. And so everything went back to normal. Business travel resumed. People were throwing big weddings. There was less social distancing, less mask compliance. And so now, you know, scientists are telling me that two things happened at once. People let their guard down, and also we've seen new variants emerge here.
Philip Reeves in Rio, when Lauren speaks about variants, I can't help but want to talk to you about that as well. Doctors Without Borders describes what's happening there in your country as a humanitarian catastrophe. We've been reporting on the variants surging in Brazil. What are you seeing there now?
It bears some similarities with what Lauren's just been talking about, but the biggest problem at the moment is a lack of sedatives and relaxants, muscle relaxants, and other medications needed for people who are in intensive care. The level of occupation, the occupancy rate of intensive care units in hospitals across Brazil has been extremely high in the last few weeks, and there have been numerous reports of hospitals running out of or getting very short of the sedatives that they need to put people onto mechanical ventilation. Some media reports have come out here in the Brazilian press about how without that, they have resorted to tying the hands of patients to the sides of their beds. Because when you wake up, when you're on a respirator, if you come out of if you become conscious again, having been unconscious, your body's natural reaction is to try to tear out the tubes, unless you have sedatives to keep you calm. And there's been pictures of patients in that condition. Efforts are being made to get more of these into the country, and some have arrived recently, but it's a very serious problem here. And so, yeah, the pandemic is out of control, badly out of control here, and it is a crisis, a humanitarian crisis.
And is the Brazilian president, Jair Bolsonaro, acknowledging yet that this problem is only getting worse?
He has started to talk about the pandemic in different language. I'm sure you remember what it was like when the pandemic first landed in Brazil, and the language that Bolsonaro used back then. He called it a little flu. He said it was nothing to be worried about. He was highly dismissive of it. And he showed that in his behavior, which undermined social distancing measures that the governors and mayors that were trying to introduce. He very rarely wore a mask. He dived into crowds. He still does that bit, but he has changed in his attitude in other areas. He talks about this being a war now against the pandemic, and he claims to be supportive of vaccines, which he certainly wasn't until recently.
Why don't we move over to Europe? Eleanor Beardsley, you're in Paris there in its third national lockdown now, because of another wave of cases. What are you seeing out your window, and what's the situation like there?
Right. Well, nothing so harrowing as what my colleagues are describing, thankfully. But, you know, the French government spokesman said that we're now at the peak of the third wave, but the lockdown, the third, as you said, is beginning to show effects. But, you know, there's nowhere to go. Everything's closed. It's sort of just like this low-grade continuation of this pandemic that just will not go away. And the government, the French government, has just banned flights from India today, and flights from Brazil were already banned. So they definitely want to keep these new mutant variants out.
You know, Europe has been sort of lagging on the vaccine front for a while now. Yesterday, an EU regulator did acknowledge a possible link to blood clots with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but also said the benefits still outweigh the risks. How would you say France is doing on the vaccine front?
Well, France started very, very slowly and was one of the worst countries. But now President Macron says it's actually got one of the highest rates of vaccination within the EU, but no one is, you know, Germany's not doing very well either. So about a quarter of the French have now had at least one dose, and it really is picking up pace. We're having mass vaccinations in stadiums. But it's true, you know, these glitches with Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, it's been a setback because, you know, not only does that, you know, Europe was counting on those vaccines, so there's been some shortages, but also it just, you know, it builds the mistrust over taking the vaccine. But Macron spoke yesterday, said it's picking up pace, and the commissioner in charge of vaccines in Europe, Thierry Breton, said that the EU should be able to have 70% of its citizens vaccinated by mid-July.
Well, that gets me to my final question, and that is whether or not you know, all three of the countries that you are in are suffering right now in one way or another. I want to ask each of you if you think there is some hope, though, even if things are difficult now, that maybe better days are ahead. Eleanor, it sounds like you're saying maybe.
Yeah, you know, the vaccines today, we were told that even without AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson, if they, you know, don't come through, that the EU can vaccinate all of its citizens by the end of the summer, because they're just ramping up production as well. More than a billion doses are going to be made. And also, you know, Peter, in mid-May, outdoor cafes in Paris may be able to reopen.
Phil, what's the hope in Brazil?
Well, we are in the tunnel, and I see no light at the end of it at this point. The vaccination program is still lagging behind many others. I think the number now for people who've had two doses is under 7%. The number of those who've had one dose is around 17%, but one dose is of no use because the vaccine that's mostly used here offers almost no protection after one dose. And matters are not made any easier, but the only other instrument you have to try to control transmission is quarantines, lockdowns, restrictions on movement. I walked out of the house the other day, walked a few blocks. It was a Saturday night. There were hundreds and hundreds of young Brazilians standing in a crowd by the seawall drinking beer for hours on end. None of them were wearing masks, almost defiantly. And yet on the other side of the street, on the sidewalk, there was the local neighborhood who were wearing masks and looking across the street, you know, disapprovingly at this group of people who obviously they perceived to be a threat, which, of course, in terms of the pandemic, indeed they are.
Lauren, what about you there in India?
I mean, it's pretty hard to be optimistic. I haven't left my house in 22 days. Lockdowns here are so strict that you're not even allowed to go out for a walk. Police are patrolling the streets. I mean, the lesson of India may be, like, we just can't let our guard down. I mean, this virus is waiting for when we do. India thought it had put this pandemic behind it. And now, you know, maybe paying the price. I look at these scenes of the U.S. and people opening up, and I really hope the pandemic is behind people there, and I hope that these variants that are still flaring in other parts of the world don't catch up with everyone.
That's Lauren Freyer in Mumbai, Philip Reeves in Rio de Janeiro, and Eleanor Beardsley reporting from Paris. Thanks to all of you. Stay well.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Peter.
One sentiment we've been hearing from people who watched the Derek Chauvin trial and murder conviction is a feeling of numbness, a lingering grief for all of those who died at the hands of police before and after George Floyd, and a feeling that one conviction won't change a policing system that's broken. Racialized trauma therapist Rezma Menakem told Here and Now that what Derek Chauvin did on camera was not to create terror in the person he was murdering, but also to create terror in the community that was left. Menakem has worked with the Minneapolis police and the state's public health department, and he joins us now. Rezma, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Rezma, one thing I've been hearing from people we spoke with today is this. If not for the video, Derek Chauvin might still be a police officer. As we take on these bigger questions about reform, how triggering is that fact for you, that an uninterrupted, uncut video was what it took to get people to believe what Black and brown people have been saying for decades?
Yeah, this is central, right? That people have confused the verdict with some sense of justice. And my friend Keith Ellison said it right. This isn't justice. This is about accountability. This video, we know, was such a you know, you could not dismiss the evidence of the video. But we also know that, you know, there was video during Rodney King. There has been video. It's just, I think at this time, it was so feral. The thing that you saw was such a representation of white body supremacy that people could not dismiss it anymore. And so I think that's key.
For this particular incident. Yes, I hear what you're saying. And yet there are significant swaths of our country who don't feel that this case serves as a larger rebuke on the system of law enforcement. There are people who don't believe that there are innocent Black and brown people who are profiled and unfairly targeted by police. This is something we don't often talk about, the pain of not being believed. How do you reconcile this when taking on trauma in your work?
Yeah, so the pain of not being believed is one thing, but I think the pain of being gaslit is a whole nother thing. Racialized gaslighting is what this country has done to Black and brown and indigenous people, you know, since Black people got here and since indigenous people were genocided off the land. That the idea that we are not to believe, especially in the face of a white body, like if a white body says something and then a body of culture says something else, what ends up happening is that the white body is always given the benefit of the doubt, right? And so this type of pain is a very long historical pain for us. So when we see something like what happened with Chauvin and we're waiting and our stomachs are clenched while we're, and we're grieving while we're watching what the verdict is going to be, there's a part of us that's hoping, that's saying, I want this verdict to be right. I want it to give some sense of accountability. And then there's another part of us that's historical, that's tied to the story, that says this will, white folks, white bodies will never admit that this system is feral and that it treats one group of people or a different group of people differently than the standard, which is the white body.
And yet you say that healing is possible. How does that happen?
Yeah. The healing is possible. I believe black bodies, indigenous bodies, brown bodies have been moving and working with this idea of racialization anyway. So we've had to begin to reclaim these ideas around healing, reclaim the ideas around who we see ourselves to be. Now, the same thing is not true collectively for the white body. The white body has not gone through a process of dealing with the idea of racialization, because they have not had to. Their lives have not depended on them understanding and having any agility with race as a collective. And so one of the ways that I think we have to begin to heal is that white bodies actually take this idea of racialization and white body supremacy seriously within their own groups, cultures, and families.
I have less than 30 seconds with you, Rezma, but what are some direct steps people can take in this moment who are feeling trauma based on all that what we've saw over the last year? How do they take their emotions that they're feeling and move it towards something?
The first thing is to turn towards each other and not on each other. Bodies of culture and black bodies specifically have to start being more gentle with each other. We have to see each other. We've internalized pieces that in terms of white body supremacy that is not helpful to us. So my first piece is, let's turn towards each other instead of on each other.
That's racialized trauma therapist and author Rezma Menakem. Rezma, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.